Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Tax Resolution Institute's Practitioners Forum, part of our Tax Tuesday series. As a reminder, our Practitioners Forum happens every first Tuesday of the month, and believe it or not, we're at the end of the year, so our next one's not going to be until January 7, 2020. So mark your calendars and join us. Make sure you join us for the first of the year. So that makes this one the last one for 2019. So thank you very much for supporting us the entire year, and we look forward to doing this again next year. Before we get started, let me go ahead and just remind everyone how these calls typically work. If you can hear the sound of my voice, then that means you've logged in correctly. Because it can be difficult to moderate all the participants we have on today, we do ask for questions to be submitted prior to the call via email. And a lot of you did respond, so we do have a hefty list here from practitioners with a lot of questions that submitted previously, or I should say online. After we get done with those, we will announce when the Q&A session is open. So you do have the ability to go ahead and ask the questions directly online, and I will get to them after we open the Q&A session. Or you can even decide to come on live and ask the question to either myself or Norman here. So again, I will announce when the Q&A session has begun, and you can submit your questions directly online or let me know that you're interested in asking the question live. Now that we got that out of the way, let's go ahead and begin. Joining us on the call today, we do have the head of our legal department at the Tax Resolution Institute, Mr. Norman Kreisman. Norman is an expert on Chapter 7, 11, and 13 debtor and creditor representation while specializing in the discharging of federal and state taxes. Norman received his BS at the Arizona State University and received his JD at Loyola Law School. Norman has represented both debtors and creditors, has a history of successful execution, and helps to identify and clarify legal issues for his clients. A seminar speaker on discharging taxes in bankruptcy, he has been admitted to practice before the U.S. Tax Court and Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. As the leader of the Tax Resolution Institute legal team, Norman is an invaluable resource both for his ability to communicate effectively with clients and his extensive experience working with the IRS and state taxation agencies. Ladies and gentlemen, Norman Kreisman.
Good morning, everybody. Be sure to check out TRI's Tax Tuesdays. On the first Tuesday of each month, like today, this practitioner's call is offered. As you know, this is a great opportunity to have your tax resolution questions answered at no cost to you. Every other Tuesday of this month, we have a free webinar on different tax resolution topics. Keep an eye out for our invitations via email for more details. All right. And if you forget when these happen, check out our course calendar at www.taxresolutioninstitute.org/courses. And remember, we're here to teach you how to make more money, work with you on your tax resolution cases, and become your trusted referral source.
Thank you very much, Norman. All right, so just we're going to go ahead and get started here with the questions in a quick minute or so, but I do want to remind everyone that our VIP members get priority on these calls. And what that means, if you are a VIP member, you not only get all the benefits as a VIP member, but you get your questions guaranteed to be answered during this forum. So the first set of questions here are coming directly from VIP members. If you are interested in becoming a VIP member, not just for this perk, but for all the other stuff that you get with it, I will be sending you a link and provide more information a little bit down the road here. All right, so let's go ahead and get started. Our first question is coming from Jason, who's a CPA. He is a VIP member, and he's asking, a new client of mine had a C corporation that is no longer in business but owes about $40,000 in payroll taxes. Please advise the best option to resolve this client tax debt. The owner is a sole owner with a W-2 job right now.
Okay, so at least in California, if a C corporation ceases doing business, then there's two ways that it can unwind. One is by filing with the Secretary of State, and that works except if the C corporation has debt, then in order to unwind with the Secretary of State, then somebody in the C corp, and in this case there's a sole shareholder, would have to pledge that they would, they're going to pay the corporation's debts. If that's not going to work, then the other way of unwinding a C corp is with bankruptcy, a Chapter 7 liquidation, and the company's out of business, and that officially winds it down. So there's no mention here. I don't know if the corporation actually wound down or just closed its doors. And the reason I bring it up is because if it just closed the doors, then there's a threat to the sole shareholder that they could be held responsible for the corporation's debts. And the whole purpose of a corporation is to avoid individual liability. So you want to check that out. The other thing is, if there's a payroll tax liability, has there been a trust fund recovery penalty assessed? And so even if the corporation did file bankruptcy or did wind down officially with the Secretary of State, the IRS can still assess the trust fund portion of the payroll tax liability to an individual. And in this case, it seems like since he was a sole shareholder, my guess is that he would be a responsible person and be liable for the trust fund. So there is not necessarily a bullet that you're going to dodge by closing the corporation without being assessed some or all of the liability.
All right, Jason, hopefully that helps you there with your C Corp client. Moving on to the next question is Mark, also a VIP member. He's asking, I appealed the audit findings for my client and my appeal was denied. I want to take it one more step. Can a CPA petition the tax court?
So when you receive the letter denying the appeal, it also gives you your appeal rights. And so one of the appeal rights may be to file a petition in tax court, and you have to be very aware of the deadline to file that petition, because once that deadline passes, the tax court no longer has jurisdiction to hear the case. So if the last date to file a petition is still open, then the question is, who can file a petition? And the answer is one of two. One is someone who's admitted to practice before the tax court, who's usually someone like a tax attorney like myself, who's admitted to practice in tax court. The other is the taxpayer themselves can file a tax court petition representing themselves. A CPA can be admitted to practice in tax court, but it's a long and difficult process because there's tests to be taken, and the test is only given every 2 years, and the pass rate of the test is very low. And so can a normal CPA without certification to practice in tax court file a petition? No. But what they could do is the taxpayers could file a petition on their own, and the CPA could represent them in settlement conferences with the IRS settlement officer and help them that way. But generally, no, a CPA can't file a petition in tax court.
All right. There you go, Mark. If you need some assistance with that, we can help you. As Norman said, Norman is admitted to petition tax court. Okay, thank you very much. Moving on to Bruce. Bruce, also a VIP member. He's asking, I submitted an offer for what I believe to be reasonable, $10,000 on $120,000 liability, and we just received the IRS letter denying the offer, stating that they believe the taxpayer can fully pay the liability. If I use the standards and follow the formula, why would the IRS deny the offer?
Okay, so the first thing I want to bring up is that when you say that an offer is reasonable based on the amount offered and the amount of the liability, that's not the way offers work. Offers is based on ability to pay, not on on a percentage of the liability. So it's not reasonable because it's 10% of the liability or whatever. It's reasonable based on taxpayers' ability to pay. And when the IRS rejected the offer, they included two charts. One is an asset equity table, which shows the taxpayers' assets and the equity in the assets, and compares it to the offer. So you'd have to look at that and see if they assigned more equity in assets than the taxpayer did in the offer. And then the other chart or table is income and expense table. So you need to look at that, and they have the income that the taxpayer listed in their 433 AOIC, and then they compare it to the income that they subscribed, and it might be based on 1099s or tax returns or some other information, and then expenses. So you might have used the standards, but sometimes it's not based on standards, it's based on actual. So you have to look at that too. So really, to answer your question on why the IRS rejected the offer, you have to look at their asset equity table and the income expense tables and see where their numbers differed from your numbers and why, and if they made a mistake or not. And then again, you have certain time to appeal. And if you think that they made a mistake, then you need to appeal it. But the answer is right in the tables that are included in the rejection letter.
All right. Thank you very much, Norman. Moving on to Andrea. Andrea is asking, how do you respond when an RO threatens to assess a trust fund recovery penalty on your client and says you can only appeal?
So I'm not sure exactly what that means, but the thing is, a lot of revenue officers take the position that they'll do what they do and then let appeals sort it out. So if they're going to assess the trust fund recovery penalty against your client, and they say that pretty much they've made their mind up, then there's really nothing you could do except once you get the notice of proposed assessment that you have, I think it's 60 days, but a certain amount of days to appeal it. So I would appeal the assessment, and that takes it out of the RO's hands and puts it into the appeals officer's hands. And if you can show why they're not a responsible person, either because they didn't have the duties that that's required to be deemed responsible, or the other part is knowledge or willfulness, and that's the second part of the test for responsible person is, did they know or should they have known that there was a tax liability that wasn't being paid while other debts were? So there's a two-prong test. So if you feel that they were incorrectly assessed, then just let the revenue officer send out the notice of proposed assessment and be sure to appeal it within the time frame.
All right. Thank you very much. And if we can just stay on that for a minute, Norman, people have to realize that someone has to be assessed the responsible person for the payroll tax liability. So when they say My client is being assessed, trust fund recovery penalty, and they're the only person responsible. Like you said, there's nothing that we can do about that.
Yeah, I mean, like that first example where they were the sole shareholder, of course they're going to be assessed. So I don't know who your client is. If they just, you know, if they just worked in a loading dock, then I don't think they're going to be assessed. But if I guess the number one qualification is that they have the ability to sign checks.
Right.
So unfortunately, sometimes that's all somebody had was that they were a bookkeeper and they wrote and signed checks, but they were told who to make checks out to and how much to make them for. That sometimes people really get assessed trust fund when they were just following orders. So that's unfortunate. But yeah, somebody's got to be assessed. And so if you think that your client shouldn't have been, then you kind of like need to point the finger at who should have been.
Right.
And that's part of the 4180. When they go through the duties, they ask who else was responsible for this. And so if there's somebody else responsible, then you need to point the finger at who should have been assessed.
And at that point, once you determine who's been assessed, and there's obviously options available then to resolve it. And one of the things that we talk about a lot is status 63, to be able to keep the IRS away from the individual.
Right, but the first step and the thing that you really have to pay most attention to is to appeal it timely. When you get that notice of proposed assessment of trust fund recovery penalty, if you don't, there's three things you can do. You can appeal it, you can do nothing, or you could sign off on it. If you sign off on it, you agree. And a revenue officer once told me, why would anybody sign off on it? If you don't sign off and do nothing, it becomes final after 60 days anyways. So it just buys more time. Or within that 60 days, you have to appeal it.
Thank you, Norman. Now, I am going to take this time now just to elaborate a little bit. The purpose of these practitioners forum calls, and this is probably appropriate because this is the last one for the year, is to provide additional information to our members and people that we associate with who are looking to do tax resolution or take on tax resolution clients as not only supplementary to their tax practice, but maybe have this become their sole practice. And one of the things that we've decided to do is come up with a certification program to allow practitioners the ability to learn the intricate details of all these types of solutions, like a status 63, or how to resolve, you know, most cases without a simple installment agreement or an offer and compromise. It's those more complicated cases that really get people hung up on. And so this certification program, if you don't know about it yet, we've been promoting it because of the next one that's coming up. It's actually our first one. It's coming up on January 15th and 16th. And we're making a big push for it now because it is limited seating. We're only certifying 10 practitioners. So we are limiting the number of seats available for this program because we want to be able to devote the necessary time for the people who sign up so that they can get undivided attention. Peter Steffen will be conducting it, and it's a 2 full-day of training. You do get hotel stay. You do get airfare allowance if you're coming from out of state, but it'll be done here in our office. And that way, you can take advantage of everything that we have. And again, Peter Steffen is the guru, as he's commonly mentioned here on our website, will have the ability. And actually, Peter, you just walked in. Did you want to say something about our certification program to everyone that's on now?
Sure. I don't know. I don't know what you've covered, Joe, but the people who are out there, you know, you probably already realize that you're doing taxes, you're in the commodity business. You know, we want to train you to get into the tax resolution business. Remember, there's no season for people not paying their taxes. You don't want to be busy 6 or 8 months a year when you can be busy all year long. You're going to do 3 to 7 years tax returns at a premium price. About a third of all collection cases start with delinquent returns. You're also going to get a premium for those returns. So your $500 return turns into $750 or 1,000 times three years or 5 years or more. You know, some people think tax resolution is just installment agreements and offers and compromise. Well, we all know out there that nothing could be further from the truth. What about certificate of release of federal tax liens, subordination agreements, trust fund recovery penalty, 4180 defenses? This is all low-hanging fruit if you've seen any of our seminars, easy ways to make money. Do you know what status 63 is? In our certification program, if you take our certification program, to make sure you're prepared, we provide you all the ammunition you need, including 2 days of intensive training, exams over the 90-day training period to make sure you understand the material. You receive a TRI tax resolution specialist designation, the tax resolution logo on your website. We never let you hang. We give you access to our new VIP Platinum program. Gives you a lot of good stuff, but most importantly, for me anyway, you get 6 hours of consultation time on any resolution matter, including document review. So we have your back if you get stuck. We'll show you how to market and sell this service. You know how to access the 15 million people that are in collection with the IRS, and that's not even including the state. Speaking of marketing, we include our professional system, which helps you streamline the process in gaining more traditional clients as well as resolution clients. There's a marketing segment, a sales segment, a resolution segment. I'm going to go on for another 30 seconds or so, but I think you're getting the picture. You receive a copy of our textbook, The Ultimate Guide to Tax Resolution, our desktop manual. How about tackling sales calls? Are you tired of spending an hour with somebody on the telephone only to have them say, I have to speak with my wife or my husband or I'll get back to you? And half the time they never do, right? Wasting all that time. We're going to help you streamline that process to make sure you get new clients. We're going to give you our professional system sales module, which you can also access through a portal on our website. For sure, you're going to be successful if you take this program. Let me sum it up. You get 2 days of intensive training, special access to our VIP Platinum program, all three modules of our professional system, our textbook, The Ultimate Guide to Tax Resolution, our Selling for Professionals book, access to webinars, access to seminars, e-learning courses, comprehensive forms library, and I can't even remember the rest of what you get. Call us to see if you qualify. We're not just taking anybody into this program. Give us a call at 800-658-7590. Aside from the phone number, I pretty much ad-libbed all that, so I hope I communicated that properly to you guys, and I'll let you get back to the call. Thanks, everybody. We're going to have a great program here in January. Joe, if you wanted to give them the dates, that's about all I don't recall here. It's a Thursday and Friday, second week of January.
Yep, January 15th and 16th. Again, we only have a few spots left, and we're limiting the people that can sign up. I'm going to push a link because I'm going to honor for the, you guys on. I'm going to honor the Black Friday deal, so I'll make sure that you guys get that discount. Thank you very much, Peter. We're going to go ahead and continue with the calls. Again, VIP members get priority. So moving on, Norman, to Becky. Becky's asking, if my client files for bankruptcy and has taxes discharged, will the IRS release the tax liens on real estate property?
So the answer is not necessarily. And the reason is that what the bankruptcy does is it discharges the tax liability against the taxpayer personally. It's called in personam. But if there's a tax lien, that's called in rem, and the tax lien stays in place. And so what you have to do is sometimes the IRS will release the lien without requesting it, but mostly you have to request that the lien be released. And depending on the bankruptcy schedules that list real and personal property, they may want the equity in a property to be paid to them in exchange to releasing the lien. So if there's equity in the home, they're going to want that equity or a portion of that equity. If there's a pension plan or a retirement plan, they're going to want you to borrow the maximum that you can from the plan and give it to the IRS in order for them to release the lien. So the lien is not automatically released on bankruptcy discharge. It's a separate issue, and hopefully the bankruptcy attorney that they go to discharge taxes understands tax bankruptcy and understands how to release tax liens, because tax-driven bankruptcies are very different than consumer-driven bankruptcies where people owe credit cards or that kind of thing. Tax bankruptcies, very different. And so the bankruptcy attorney discharging taxes should be familiar with the process of releasing liens.
All right, Norman, thank you very much for that. Becky, again, Norman is a specialist in bankruptcy. If you have any questions, use some of that consultation time to give him a call and just bend his ear a little bit to help you out with this. Moving on to Arnie, also a VIP member. When preparing an OIC, the only asset the client has is his IRA, which apparently has about $85,000 in it. It's his only source of retirement. Can that amount be excluded based on hardship? What is the best way to handle this problem?
Okay, so remember that an OIC is based on equity on assets and also disposable income, which is income minus expenses. So I don't know what their income expense ratio is, but usually an IRA would have a value based on current value. So if it's a kind of plan where they can't get to it until they reach a certain age and they're not of that age, then it really has no fair market value. If they can borrow against it, then it has the value of what they can borrow. Sometimes it's like 50% of the book value. Also, it doesn't say what their age is. So if they're getting close to retirement or if they're in retirement, then that has to be taken into account. And besides the IRA, they would also be receiving, I imagine, Social Security. So that would also affect their income and expenses if that IRA is really necessary. Then you may submit an offer, but you may do an offer not as doubt as to collectability, but as to effective administration, which means that it would be a hardship. So examples of that is where there's somebody might own their home free and clear, and so, but rather than look at the equity of the home, and, you know, with the advice that they sell the home and give the equity to the IRS, that they stay living in the house because they couldn't afford to live anywhere else. If they're only on Social Security or something, and that's only enough for their food and possibly medication and other things, then it may be determined that they need to be able to live in a rent-free house because they couldn't afford rent anywhere else. So those are the kinds of things to look at. So it may be, but it may not be under doubt as to collectability or liability. It may be under effective tax administration, which is a third kind of offer, which is rarely used. And that's because it's rarely accepted. You have to really be in dire straits to qualify.
All right. Thank you very much, Norman. The next question here, also from a VIP member, is Musa. Musa's asking, my client just recently acquired a home healthcare business that has outstanding payroll tax liability. The previous owners have not been assessed, and I'm trying to negotiate a payment plan. The IRS wants to interview both the new owner and the old owner. Do I have a chance of having the IRS assess the new owner only? The business has the potential being very profitable, so the new owner wants to contain the liability so she doesn't have to sign up, doesn't have to give up anything if the IRS assesses the previous owner personally.
Okay, so there's a couple things. One is, was the home healthcare business a corporation? And was it an asset sale or a stock sale? So that would be something I would need to know. And the other thing is that if you're going to be assessed a trust fund liability, you had to be responsible person. So the new owners, I don't see how they could be held responsible for the actions of the old owners because they weren't there, so they didn't have the responsibilities and they didn't have the willfulness because they weren't involved. But if it was a stock sale, then the new owners would be liable for corporate taxes or corporate liabilities. So even if they weren't assessed trust fund recovery penalty, the new owners may still be liable for the tax liability of the old owners in the corporation, because by purchasing the stock of the corporation, they basically purchased the assets as well as the liabilities. So that's now on the new owners of the corporation. So those are the kinds of things that I would need to know to give you a more specific answer.
All right. Thank you very much, Norman. Moving on to Ramon. Ramon, also a member, is asking, do you create a tolling period when having a taxpayer in Status 63 or CNC?
Yeah, so the good news is no. Time in CNC or Status 63, which has to do with trust fund recovery penalty and an installment agreement for the corporation for the entire payroll tax liability. But no, being in currently non-collectible status does not toll the statute on collection. But remember, CNC means currently non-collectible, which means it's a temporary status. So usually they check every couple years to determine whether or not the situation has changed. So although you may be in currently non-collectible status now, it doesn't mean that you're going to remain in CNC for the duration of the statute.
All right, moving on to Daniel, also a member. I have a prospective client who has not filed returns in about 8 years. My questions are, do we have to prepare all unfiled returns? And number two, where do we begin to gather income information? He's held several jobs throughout this time and does not have records. I think transcripts I can only get the last 3 to 4 years of wage and income. Your guidance is appreciated.
Okay, so I'm assuming based on the information that he's had several jobs is that he was a W-2 employee. And so do you have to prepare all unfiled returns? I would say yes for W-2 employees unless he made below filing requirements, but that's pretty low. And so my guess is if he was an employee that he would have to file those returns. And then the second thing is, where do you get the information? So yeah, you're right. You would request wage and income transcripts But I don't think wage and income transcripts are only for the last 3 or 4 years.
No, you can go beyond that.
You can go back, I think, 10 years for wage and income transcripts. So I would get wage and income transcripts and base the returns on the information on the wage and income transcripts. You may have to, I don't know if you could itemize, you might have to just take standard deductions, but yeah, you definitely want to file all those returns.
Now, we run into this situation regularly, but it's mostly Schedule C taxpayers or sole proprietors those become troubling.
Because then they may not have a filing requirement because the only income that the IRS would be aware of would be 1099s. And so if they didn't receive any 1099s, as far as the IRS is concerned, they have no record of anything that would require that they file returns, except, for instance, like in the state of California, if you don't file a return, but you have a home, then they estimate your income to be four times the amount of interest that you paid in, that the 1099 would show on
the mortgage interest.
Mortgage interest that you paid. And so they would take that mortgage interest number and multiply it by four and say that was your gross income.
Or if you hold a professional license, they do the average by professional.
Right. Or they might do average. Yeah. So if you have a license, then it would be average of that profession.
So get your returns filed, everyone. Okay, moving on to Jessica. Can trust fund taxes be discharged in bankruptcy?
So if we're talking about trust fund taxes, then it's assessed against an individual. So probably we're talking about either a Chapter 7 bankruptcy or a Chapter 13. It would be an 11 if they owed beyond the debt limits of a 13. But let's assume that they qualify for a 7 or a 13. So in a Chapter 7, the trust fund taxes would not be discharged because it would be a priority tax, and priority taxes aren't discharged. If it was a 13, you would have to pay the amount of the trust fund taxes in the 13 over 5 years. On monthly payments to the Chapter 13 trustee. So in a sense, they would be discharged in the sense that at the end of the Chapter 13, there wouldn't be any tax owed, but that's because in order to get the discharge, you would have to pay it. The good news is that if there's no tax liens or if the value of the assets are less than the amount of taxes owed, you could pay that without accruing interest. So you save the interest that's been accruing while you're in the plan. So sometimes people file 13 and they know that they have to pay it, but it's a better deal than being in an installment agreement. Because when you're in an installment agreement, the interest continues to accrue.
All right, moving on to Sam. Sam is asking, client wants me to file 4 years delinquent returns because he knows he will owe for these years and wants to file a bankruptcy as soon as collection activity begins. Can you explain the rules for discharging taxes? What is the waiting period?
Yeah, so I can tell you that if he files bankruptcy as soon as collection activity begins, he's going to be in big trouble because of the rules. So I'm assuming that you're a CPA or an enrolled agent or a tax preparer and not a bankruptcy attorney. And so I think your advice is pretty limited to that they should seek the counsel of a qualified bankruptcy attorney familiar with discharging taxes in bankruptcy. Because the thing is, if they owe 4 years of delinquent returns, let's say 15, 16, 17, and 18, where, well, 16, 17, and 18 are going to be in trouble for the three-year rule. And even the earliest year, the four years ago liability, although it passes a three-year test, there's also a two-year test, which is 2 years from the filing of the return. So if you're filing 4 years of tax returns all at once, then even if the 3 years expired or is going to expire, you now have the two-year problem. So the short answer is that they're going to have to wait at least 2 years from the date that they file those delinquent returns till they file bankruptcy. And for some years, depending on which years are delinquent, they may have to wait all 3 years. So the short answer is they are not going to benefit by filing immediately on when collection activity begins. They're going to have to wait 2 or 3 years. So what you could do is maybe put them in an installment, a low monthly installment agreement, keep the IRS off their back, or put them in currently non-collectible status or something, so that the next 2 or 3 years, they don't have to look over their shoulder at the IRS coming for them. And because an installment agreement or CNC doesn't toll those rules, so you could buy time that way.
All right, Norman, thank you very much. We're nearing the end of the pre-submitted questions. So those of you that are online and have a question, please go ahead and submit them. We're going to be opening it up to the Q&A session here. Some of you have already submitted questions. Thank you for that. Go ahead and submit questions, or let me know that you want to come on, and we will turn on the speakers and hear your question. But moving on here, Norman, this is from Lisa. Lisa's asking, can a responsible person for 941 taxes be classified as currently non-collectible if his financials prove it? Will they review the corporation financial as well?
Okay, so when you say responsible for 941 taxes, I'm not sure if you're referring to trust fund recovery penalty or the full 941 taxes, because if the business, for instance, is a sole proprietorship, then the sole proprietor is liable for the entire 941 payroll tax liability and really doesn't need to be assessed the trust fund recovery penalty because they're already responsible for the whole thing. The trust fund recovery penalty would be for like corporations and other entities. So I don't know if this is a sole prop or something else. I don't know if we're talking about 941 liability or trust fund recovery penalty. But the answer is that a responsible person could be put into currently non-collectible. But more importantly is if the corporation has, if there's trust fund recovery penalty, then there's also payroll tax liability. So besides trying to collect from the responsible person, they're also going to try to collect from the corporation or the business that owes the payroll tax liability. And another form of currently non-collectible is called status 63, which means that if the responsible person doesn't owe any other taxes besides the trust fund recovery penalty, and the business is in an installment agreement to pay the payroll tax liability, that they won't seek collection against the responsible person. So the responsible person, even though they owe it, the collection is in abeyance as long as the corporation stays in compliance and makes their installment agreement payments.
All right, Lisa, there you go. Hopefully that answers your question. And moving on to Tammy. Tammy asked the question, on a tax lien notice, what does column E mean, date for refiling? And she actually sent us a copy of a tax lien notice that she was looking at.
So a notice of federal tax lien could be for one or more years. And the first column is the kind of tax, like, for instance, 1040. The second is the tax period ending, so that's, you know, 1231, whatever tax year they're talking about. And then the date of assessment. And the reason that the date of assessment is important is because the collection statute is 10 years from the date of assessment. And so if the 10 years passes from the date of assessment and there's been no tolling events, no bankruptcies, no tax court petitions, no collection due process hearings, then when the collection statute expires 10 years from the date of assessment, the lien is self-releasing. It automatically releases. But if there's been some tolling on the date of assessment, then there's a window, and it's 1 year and 1 month. And so what column E is, a last day for refiling, means if there's been a tolling of the collection statute, then within that window, the IRS can refile the notice of tax lien. And it's good for another 10 years. But when the collection statute expires, depending on how long it's been tolled, then the IRS is instructed to manually go in within 30 days from the collection statute expiration date and manually release the lien. So the lien can either be self-releasing if it's done at the CSED date, or if the CSED date's been tolled, then it could be manually released when the CSED finally passes. So what the column E is the last day for them to file a new lien. But again, that would be true only if the collection statute has been tolled.
All right, moving on here to one of you folks online that's asking me. This is coming from Richard. IRS has made adjustments to the taxpayer tax returns, and the taxpayer owes money to the IRS. The taxpayer also will owe money to the FTB. Do you have any general guideline regarding how to coordinate handling of the tax resolution between federal and FTB? Do you finish the IRS first and then handle the state, or do both at the same time?
Okay, so it really depends on who's being more aggressive. Usually in California, the Franchise Tax Board is more aggressive than the IRS, so you may want to deal with the FTB first. But whoever is seeking to levy wages or levy bank accounts, or who is ever being more aggressive, you want to deal with them first. And when you do the financials, for for the other taxing agency after setting up an installment agreement with one. That installment agreement will reduce your disposable income, and so could reduce the pay the payment to of an installment agreement to the second entity. But you have to be careful, because if you pledge all your disposable income to one, the other one's not going to sit by and say, well, since there's nothing left now that you've got an installment agreement with the other, I guess we'll put you in CNC. It won't work that way. So you want to be careful not to give everything to one, because then the other is going to want something. Sometimes it's based on proportionate. So like if your payment to the FTB is $1,000 a month based on $50,000, and you owe the IRS twice that, then the IRS is going to want twice that in installment payments. And the same thing with the FTB, it's called proportionate payment. So they're going to look at how much you owe the other agency and how much your payment plan is for. So there really is no hard and fast rule on which one to handle first. I would just handle whichever one is making the most noise first.
All right, Norman, this is coming from Janesh. And Janesh, thank you very much for joining us again. I have a client who wants to do an OIC with the IRS. 2 months have passed, and now the husband's health has left him invalid, and they want to file for bankruptcy. Do I cancel the OIC, or what should I do? So I'm assuming he filed it, and 2 months have passed since he filed
the OIC. So the OIC has already been filed.
Right.
So this is something, again, that they need to discuss with their bankruptcy attorney. It's really not their tax preparer or their CPA or their enrolled agent's advice on what to do. But I can tell you that, number one, it would depend on whether or not they're contemplating a Chapter 7 or a Chapter 13. There is some recent case law that's kind of interesting that says that you can reduce the liability in a Chapter 13 to the amount of the offer. But that's not true everywhere. And it's whether or not the offer has been accepted or not, and whether or not that means that the IRS is then stuck with that number. So I think it's a call that their bankruptcy attorney needs to make. Now, the other way around, you can't submit an offer while you're in bankruptcy. That's just, if you go through the offer checklist, one question is, are you in a bankruptcy? And you check yes, it says stop. You can't file a OIC. But having a pending OIC does not prevent you from filing bankruptcy. It just may not be the wisest thing to do. So that's a call. I can't answer that because I don't know what chapter. I don't know how much they owe. I don't know how much their offer was. But submitting an offer doesn't prevent you from filing bankruptcy. But you may want to voluntarily withdraw the OIC before filing the bankruptcy.
All right. Looks like we have time for maybe one or maybe two questions. Next one is coming from Charlie. I have a client who owes $45,000, and we're considering submitting an offer because his house is underwater at the moment. The only other asset he has is a retirement account with approximately $30,000 and very little disposable income. Can the negative equity in his home offset the retirement asset when considering the offer?
Sorry, but the answer is no. you can't, you have to look at each one separately. So if you can't go negative. So if he's upside down in the house, then the equity is zero. It's not a negative number. Same thing's true, for instance, on net rental income. If you're losing money, you can't go negative. All you can do is do zero. So, so equity in the home would be zero. It wouldn't be a negative number. And then the retirement account, the fair market value of that is determined by whether or not they can borrow against it, how long they have until they can withdraw from it, what their age is, and that kind of stuff. But the question was, can the negative equity in his home offset the retirement asset? And the answer is no.
But it still looks like you may have an offer here if what you say is proven true, that they have very little disposable income. That single asset is valued somewhere between 60 to 80%. Yeah. It's still, if that's their only asset.
Like I would value it at 15,000 normally.
Right.
Because if you, but again, we don't know what their age is.
Right. So there are a couple other factors there. But Charlie, give us a call. Consider becoming a VIP member if you want us to help you calculate that for you. Looks like time for one more, Norman. This is from Henry. I have a client for whom I've negotiated several installment agreements, and the IRS, like clockwork, asks for a new 433F every couple years. Is there anything I can do to stop the IRS constant review of my client's financials? There is equity in their home, so the OIC will cause them to sell home, and they don't want to do that.
Okay, so there's broadly two kinds of installment agreements. A full pay installment agreement, which will full pay the tax liability within the collection statute, or a partial pay, which won't. And so it's going to pay until the statute, and then that year becomes uncollectible and falls off. So my guess is if they're asking for new 433F every couple of years, that it might be a partial pay installment agreement. And so the reason they're doing that is to see if the taxpayer has an ability to full pay. Because if you have an installment agreement that's full pay, the IRS will pretty much leave it alone because they're going to get paid in full. But a partial pay is something else. And before they forgive the balance of the taxes owed, they want to be sure that the taxpayer's making their best effort. So if you wanted to avoid coming back every couple of years with a new 433F, I would see what they would need to pay every month to make it a full pay installment agreement. And that may be a better way to go, or it may be out of bounds for them, because the IRS would look at each year that's owed and the collection statute and the payment, the monthly payment amount, rather than based on ability to pay, is based on what needs to be paid within the each year's collection statute in order to pay out before the statute expires. And then just one other thing is, if you submit an offer and you have equity in your home, it doesn't mean that they're going to cause them to sell the home. It means that they want that if they're going to accept the offer, that you have to, the offer has to be for the amount of equity in their home. And so they could do, they can get a home equity loan or something, and they could pay the IRS the equity based on the home equity loan. And that's why they go by 80% loan to value, because then you have that that 80%, and you have the 20% where they know you're not going to be able to borrow more than 80% of the value of your home. And so it's, they're not going to cause them to sell their home. They're just, they're going to only accept the offer if the total equity in their home is all eaten up by loans.
All right, Norman. Well, thank you very much for that. This does bring us to the end. I do want to apologize to Jessica, Esther, and Milton for not getting into your questions. I am going to save them in our bank and try to get them answered next year. If your question requires a response sooner than that, if you're dealing with a client now that needs that question answered, give us a call. Consider becoming a VIP member. Use that certification, sorry, the consultation time, and we can help you with that question. A reminder, that certification program, we are extending it one more day for the Black Friday deal. So if you are interested, look at the chat box. I pushed the link as well as the promo code. You can also give us a call at the office, 818-658-7590. Ask for Michael, Sam, or myself, and we can give you more details on the certification program. Again, thank you very much, everyone. It's been a great year. Happy holidays to everyone that's on. We look forward to doing this again next year. Anything that, any suggestions that you might have on how to improve this or change the practitioners forum on a monthly basis, feel free to contact me directly. My email is joe@ssttax.com, joe@ssttax.com. Again, thanks again for another great year, and we look forward to doing it again. See you soon.